You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show, rated the number one podcast of all time.
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 Make sure you're ready, because this is the podcast where you are guaranteed to learn virtually everything.
All right, everybody, this is the Brian Callen Show, and I am here with a former Delta commando, a Delta operator, Tom Bigley. And I think that you also did some other stuff for the U.S. government I can't go into.
Right.
But it just sounds very good. And I'm looking at you with your Marine,
very short hair.
You got short hair. You're high
it's
and tight.
It's long right now.
You got a salt and pepper goatee.
Yes.
And no neck.
That's good. Okay,
and no
that's
neck,
good.
Ladies and gentlemen.
No waist either.
And no waist.
No, I got a waist. Sorry. It's the opposite of that.
It's a very sexy waist. He's built like an hourglass. High, tight ass.
Yeah, great.
A lot of fast twitch muscle. You have thick hands, by the way.
I've heard that, yes.
Yeah. I noticed that. I feel like a little bit of a girl. I met Tom. I was doing stand-up here in Seattle, which is where we're recording this, and I was I was mentioning Delta Force and his lovely wife, Melinda Bigley, who, by the way, has a book called Watching Over Us. It's by Melinda Lambert Bigley, and you can get it online. And she is a photojournalist, so take a look at it. And get it. You can get it online. Is there a particular website they should go to?
You go to Amazon, I think, right?
Yeah. Go to Amazon and get it. It's called Watching Over Us.
You could answer that.
They can't hear her. It's just you and I on our mics. She's just our audience.
Okay.
And then you and his wife said my husband was Delta Force, and everything stopped in my show. It fucking stopped. I was like, we got to stop everything, because I've never actually met a real Delta Force command.
My heart stopped, because I don't like to talk about
that. Do you consider yourself a commando or an operator? Why do they say you guys are operator?
An operator.
That sounds so ominous, but so ridiculously cool. Let's talk a little bit about why. I want to know about your background, and I want to know, and we're going to talk about what it takes to be a Delta Force operator, but more importantly, I want to get your perspective on foreign policy, on how your point of view has changed about war, about American foreign policy, about how to avoid conflicts, or how to deal with conflicts like Iraq and Afghanistan in the future. I want to get your point of view on that, because I know, you're a Delta Force guy, and you people want to ask you questions like, what kind of guns did you use and all that.
I get a lot of that.
I'd imagine that gets very old and boring. So we're going to talk. We're going to have an
foreign policy is new. I don't do too much of that. So that's interesting.
Well, I'm interested because you're somebody who has been on, truly on the front lines and done things that you probably can't talk about. And I guess the bottom line is you've gotten your hands dirty, whereas you're not. Talk to a CIA analyst and they're more theoretical. They're behind a desk and they're looking at numbers and things like that. When I talk to a guy like you, you've been up close and personal, and there's got to be a very different perspective, right?
Yes, but I think I think in the theory sense about what the world is doing and what's going on in the world is something that you need to educate yourself about. Now, I do know Rangers and Delta operators that have a mindset of, hey, if they give me orders to invade New Jersey, I'm there. They don't see it in the big picture. And I don't sit there and say that I analyzed missions to say were these justified or not. I did what I was told.
Well, you
to
can't.
Do.
I would imagine that when you have a mission, it's a linear thing. You got to go do the mission. But what I thought was interesting is talking to you in a brief time. We started talking. You have a real command of history, and especially about the Middle East, which was very interesting to me.
Yeah, I don't think everybody has that, but I think it's important to understand the picture of history and why we're doing certain things. And some people would disagree with this, perhaps, but I know that we invaded Afghanistan for a particular purpose, and there's arguments that we invaded Iraq based on George Bush's opinion and so forth, and false intelligence and things like that. I think those are reasonable, true statements. However, I do also think historically it was the right thing to do.
Mm.
Not that.
Why?
Because I think there was a threat there, and we used them against Iran historically, if you want to.
Yes,
you
we
know,
did.
The U.S. supported Saddam in the fight with Iran, which was the right thing to do at that time. Once they stepped over the line and invaded Kuwait, now I think his father should have done it first. I don't think they should have waited. But they did, and they let all these things build up, and then they got to that point and used a WMD excuse, so forth. Now, I've been in places in Iraq that have things that they weren't supposed to have, violating UN treaties, and they were it was common knowledge.
Meaning what? Having what?
Cobalt-60, nuclear material, things like that in the Tuatha site that's not classified. And the Bush administration never expounded on that and said, hey, there were reasons to be in here. Biological weapon factories and so forth.
The way I always, and tell me what you think of this perspective, the way I always look at it is when, you know, when those planes flew into those buildings, you know, that was a shock to everybody, including our intelligence community, I would imagine. Mm-hmm. And, I, you know, everybody says, well, we knew, we should have known. Look, hindsight's always 20/20. That was a low-tech, high-concept idea. Fanatics, history shows us, are capable of doing pretty spectacular things when you've got young men, idealistic men, who are willing to do whatever it takes, including die for a cause. They can cause a lot of damage. Nobody saw it coming. I read Bob Woodward's book, Bush at War. One of the things you get from that book is nobody knew what the fuck to do at this point. We were trying to figure out a way to keep a mushroom cloud from forming over an American or European city. And one of the things I thought was interesting is Henry Kissinger said, look, people are talking about Iraqi sovereignty. There is no such thing. Saddam Hussein has hijacked that country. His hero is Joseph Stalin. This is not a democratic man. What we are dealing with is living in a world where it's becoming more and more possible that someone, if they are motivated enough, can get their hands on the kind of technology that could kill 100,000 plus people. That cannot be. And what you have to do is send a very clear message to any country that thinks there's any profit in supporting a group willing to do that. You've got to send a very clear message that if you think there's profit in dropping a weapon of mass destruction into some fanatical group's hands, because fanatical groups need a country, a host country, for a lot of reasons. If you think there's any profit in that, it'll be the end of your regime. We're going to come in and fucking kill you.
Yeah, and even with the change. I think
that's a persuasive argument.
It is, and that's exactly what's occurring. And even with the change in administration, we're in Yemen. We're fighting these people on the front lines. And people will argue about Barack Obama's
drone.
Well, not just his drone program, but his intensity that he's not maybe going after things as intense as he should. I think the U.S. government is doing exactly what they did. They didn't change any of the Bush policies in reference to listening to U.S. phone calls versus all those things that were big issues back with aren't so much issues anymore because the Democrats don't necessarily want to profile them, but it's all still occurring. And we're still in all these countries. We just sent people to Mali. There's no love lost in what's occurring there in the northern part of Mali. And these things are going to occur. And I agree with you that if you, in a simple sense, put the smack down on these people when they try to get out of line like this, and Iran's an issue. And it's going to have to come to a head at some point because they are a state sponsor of terrorism.
Are they really? Is there any value in just ignoring Iran or actually bringing them into the fold?
Yeah, but if you tell people that you're going to wipe Israel off the map, regardless of whether it's a statement to get the people's blood up, you know, they've got a lot of progressive people in Iran.
Yes.
Prior to Khomeini, that was a very westernized country.
They still do. A lot of them
are young
people.
They haven't forgotten
that.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah.
And I don't know specifically, but I think we're in there instigating the
Tom, why are you smiling? Tom,
because I think
Tom,
we
hold
are.
On. Tom, I feel like you're smiling. Tom, yeah, are you I'm saying smiling. On the Brian Callen show that we might be instigating Iran to
no, the
react
population?
To
I hope we are.
Jesus,
how's
Tom?
That? I hope we are.
Yeah, but
I don't speak for U.S. policy.
I understand, but you're raising that. A very important question. There is a question now: is have we gotten too good at killing? And more importantly, who is really calling the shots? Let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. Okay. We killed an American citizen. This guy, Anwar Alawak.
Yes, I know that.
And we also killed his son, who was 16 years old, who grew up in Colorado. My worry now is that we're killing American citizens without due process. And secondly, you are relegating that authority to a, quote, high-ranking defense official. That was the legal justification. That gets me a little bit worried when a government, because you know I'm a libertarian, we talked about this, when a government becomes a little too powerful without accountability and nobody's watching this stuff, I get very nervous. If you're starting to kill American citizens for inciting violence without due process, we have to have a conversation, I think. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think Alawaki, and it's unfortunate about his son, but there is always collateral damage in certain things. Nothing is that surgical. Things aren't that surgical. Mm. Sometimes they can be. You know, you can snipe a guy from a certain distance.
And you were a sniper, by the
yes,
way.
Yes, I was. And
you're listening to a Delta sniper.
Nah, I didn't snipe anybody. But the fact is, you can affect targets sometimes with other munitions like they did with Alawaki. And they've done it in Afghanistan and they've done it in Iraq and so forth. Mm. And I think as soon as those people cross the line that they are sitting in Yemen, in this case, inciting violence against the United States, and then they've made that choice. They've made that choice to be in Yemen. If they were in Chicago, the FBI would arrest them. Maybe kill them in the takedown part of it if they were resisting. But I think it's absolutely justified if you're going to sit there and swear allegiance to whoever, I don't care who it is, and incite violence against the United States, they have a duty to protect American citizens.
But shouldn't that be decided in a court of law if you're an American citizen?
Not always. I mean, policemen shoot people that are resisting because they're a threat.
Okay.
I think in utopia, it would be perfect, but things aren't that perfect.
Yeah.
The fact is, this guy was inciting major, if he had the opportunity to do what you said is form a mushroom cloud over a U.S. city, he would have done it. So we need to act. We have a responsibility to our citizens. Does that mean we disregard the Constitution? No. Mm. But you have a responsibility also, and that's what people forget, that citizens have a responsibility not to cause violence against each other, and hence when police get involved and a guy's in a, is it not due process of a police storm a bunker that's got some kid hostage and kill the guy, and then they could say, well, he didn't get a trial either.
Right.
That's right, because he chose to that path.
Yes.
And this guy chose a path too.
Right. So the justification being that we took out somebody who was actively planning, plotting, and inspiring the killing of American citizens.
Absolutely.
And because he was in a separate sovereign country, we couldn't actually drop a bunch of guys like you in there to snatch them
up. Well, we could.
We could have, but it would have been very dangerous.
Maybe that was not an option, because now we're putting more people at risk. You know, they dropped
bombs. And diplomatically,
too. Well, they dropped nuclear bombs in Japan. Mm. Arguably, the problem with invading the country was going to put a million plus Americans at risk.
That's right.
So they didn't.
Yep.
And they exterminated in a second, 200,000 people.
Yep.
Arguably the worst thing that has occurred since, World War II in a lot of people's minds. However, in our position, perhaps justifiable. I mean, other people say no. There's people that say everything that goes on in war is wrong.
No.
Okay, well, let me tell you something. It's a violent world out there, and people want what you have.
Well, when they say that, Tom, when they say war is wrong across the board, you know what I say? I say war got rid of a couple things. Fascism,
Stalin,
slavery in this country.
Not Stalin so much.
Slavery in this country.
Absolutely.
And by the way, this guy was talking about Rwanda, and he wrote a book called We Wish to Inform You That We and Our Families Will Be Killed. I can't remember the title, but they said he was talking about how the UN argued for 6 weeks over the rental fees for armored cars, over the rental fees, and as a result, 300,000 people were killed in that 3 months. It was the most ferocious, concentrated killing. They said, "What would you do to stop something like Rwanda again?" And he said, "What would I do? I would take some rapid reaction forces. I'd take some commandos with helicopter gunships and RPGs and whatever, and as soon as I saw any group of men in a big truck with machetes, I would fucking kill them."
Yeah.
And what would happen is every man would start, and you send out a communique and you go, hey, anybody who gets in, if you're in a group with your buddies with machetes in a truck and you're driving, you're dead. Let me tell you something. We would have stopped
It would have stopped.
So there is no
because
question
it's
in
force.
My mind.
It's there's
force.
Only there's only certain things that you can deal with without force.
That's right.
At some point, with human nature and all these other things that you're dealing with throughout history. And we can say that we're evolving and we're more progressive and all this stuff, but human nature hasn't changed, and people are going to try to take advantage of other people. I'll tell you an interesting question I asked some local Iraqis that were in the 2005-06 time frame when things were getting really bad in Baghdad, and they were like, oh, this occupation is terrible. You know, in 2003 they were all happy, and same people. I said, what other country would you rather have invade you? I understand we're occupiers. We invaded your country. Let me just ask you, who else on the planet would you rather invade you? The Russians? The Chinese?
No.
Let's think about it. Whoever, Europe, you want them in here? They had no answer because the Americans, for the most part, there was some atrocities
sure.
and so forth. People are people. But no country has ever invaded a region because it wasn't really just Afghanistan or... We invaded a region, yeah. politically in some cases.
I always say that to people. I say Afghanistan has always been a series of tribes, not a country. You're Pashtun, you're Tajik, you're Hazara.
To Alexander, yeah. he abandoned the country
yeah.
because he killed all the people in the flatlands, and he was getting attacked from Waziristan constantly. And all, yeah. you know? And he went back to Iraq right. and left them.
Right.
And so, you know, 400 BC, he was like, this place sucks, and we're out of here. and he invaded... India.
Right.
So,
right.
you know,
right.
And he was successful, actually. Yeah. But, and actually all the...
So you said, who would you rather have...
Who would you rather have invade your country? And they region, have no answer, yeah. or your region. But sure. I was talking to Iraqis, and I said, sorry. So, you know, the U.S. hasn't come in here and taken over everything. Yeah, we displaced the police and the military. A lot of mistakes were made,
yeah.
in hindsight. However... You know, Paul Bremer did the best job he could. You know, there was some really positive things that came out of that. And what it showed to the world was the U.S. is a serious combat force. We invaded the largest ground territory faster than anybody ever had done sure. in history against the fourth or fifth largest mechanized force in the planet.
Would you do what? How do you
not Delta Force either? The U.S. Army.
The U.S. Army, yeah. You know? And you were. How long were you in Delta for?
7 years.
7 years, mm-hmm. and then you went on to do other things.
I went on to do things with the other parts of the army and other people.
Yeah, yeah. And other people.
Yeah.
I remember being in Afghanistan and how everybody is secretive. You ask some guy who's wearing sunglasses, what do you do? And they're like, this and that. It's so great.
Thanks. Who are you?
Yeah, exactly. But. You know, having said that, there is still the question of when you invade a country, you've got to deal with what you know you could call blowback. You've got to deal with what is the situation and the legacy you are leaving. And when it comes to combat, you've got to make sure you're not creating more terrorists. You and I are men. We're mm-hmm. men. You kill my family, I'm sure. coming for you.
Sure.
And I think from what I have read, the U.S. government, the U.S. military, and they've done a damn good job. When I was out there, those guys were building hospitals and orphanages. That's what I saw. But absolutely. but we also had guys who were taking out enemy threats and things.
Yeah.
The question is, when somebody shoots at you with a long rifle and they run into a house, you don't drop a 1,000-pound bomb on the fucking house and kill right, everybody inside. Right. And that's what we were doing, maybe still are doing. That's got to be contrary to winning hearts and minds.
Well, I don't think we're doing that
okay.
in every case.
Okay.
I think there's, well, first of all, certain people will put, you know, human shields up. I mean, at the point, you have to give it the responsibility to them.
Okay.
You know we're targeting you. If you surround yourself with a bunch of women and children, you're going to affect them if we're dropping bombs on you.
Gotcha.
If we're walking in there to take the house down, that's a different story. You know, we've rescued hostages and so forth and done things. But, you know, they get responsibility for understanding they're in a combat situation. You know, extremist Islam is fighting the United States actively right now. You know, you get in a safe house somewhere on the border of Afghanistan or on the border of Pakistan, and a bomb comes off of a drone and kills your family. Guess what? You shouldn't be transmitting out of your house or whatever you're doing.
You're putting your own family at risk.
You're putting yourself at risk.
That makes sense.
And they know that. It's like
the
truckload of machetes.
Sure.
You know, if you bring your kids with you,
yeah.
and, you know, all week everybody with machetes hanging out their windows is getting blown up. You know, what do you expect?
Right.
The fact is that we are as selective. Well,
as
the,
you can
the Russians
as you can
invaded
be.
Chechnya because of a Muslim problem.
They just blew up everybody.
They leveled the city.
I know.
They killed
everybody.
Droves and droves of people.
The U.S. has not done that. Yeah.
You know, we're very selective. I've had the opportunity many times to drop a 1,000-pound bomb on a home, and I knew that the collateral damage was going to be a factor, and we didn't do it.
Mm.
The benefit of killing one guy and then maybe 20 other people
didn't
make any sense.
So that's not lost on guys like you. Guys who, you know, combat action groups and stuff. You guys know. It's like, I love when people like, you know, they say, well, the military is doing this. You guys know that argument, obviously.
Sure.
You don't want to make your life harder. You're also humane. You're also,
right.
You know, you're also moral, ethical people for the most part.
Now, there's bad guys in there.
Of course.
I think there's
like,
bad guys everywhere.
Everywhere.
There is a very small amount of criminal type activity that I would consider criminal activity. It's not like these guys are like, yeah, let's think it's funny, let's kill a bunch
of
people.
No, of course not.
They don't.
Of course not.
These are serious professionals, whether it's government agencies or military. You know, I just believe this truly, and I know most of them, that they're all trying to do the right thing. For not only for the country, but for themselves personally.
I believe that.
They don't want to live with that.
Yeah, I believe that 100%. It's certainly what I felt, what I saw. It was only 2 weeks. I have no right to even say, but I just know human nature, human beings. People mm-hmm. are people going, you can call them idealistic, but I do not believe that most people are going there. You know, you're always going to have sociopaths. It's probably 1% of you know, any group. But for the most part, people are in there trying to make a difference. And so that leads me to my next question. Are you optimistic about Iraq's future? Are you optimistic about Afghanistan's future? And I'm talking 10, 20 years down the line. I know it's hard to be an oracle.
Future?
That's
no,
hard. No.
Absolutely not.
No.
Afghanistan is one of the worst places in the world.
Yeah. And you spent a lot of time
there. And it's never going to be any different. And it always has been that way. Historically, the British got kicked out of there. You know, we're not going to get kicked out of there. We're going to leave. But that country is going to stay. It has no natural resources. There's a lot of issues with Afghanistan.
They're also a fairly, like, they're a very warlike people. I mean, they always have been.
Yeah.
Why is that?
They're tribes, and
they
have warring, you know, warlords, and they still do right now.
Yeah.
Basically, the president is the head warlord. You know, he's not.
If I made you emperor and I put you in a time machine and brought you back 10 years, and you could call the shots in Afghanistan, what do you think you would have done differently? It's kind of a theoretical question.
Well, you know, I don't think anything. I don't think the only way to deal with those people is with an iron hand, unfortunately. Iraq is a completely different story.
Are you optimistic about Iraq?
I'm optimistic about Iraq because even regardless of all the bad things that Saddam was doing, he was a progressive guy. For the Sunnis, the most part, he crushed the Shia.
Yeah.
I get it. But all the women didn't have their hair covered. They were westernized. The guys were in suits. They weren't in dish doshes. You know, you go to Kuwait, they're required to wear, the men are required to wear a certain uniform.
Mm.
In Saudi Arabia, there's all these rules about what you can do as a man and a woman.
That's right.
People think they only apply to women. They don't.
No.
They apply to men, too.
Very, Wahhabi Islam is a puritanical sect of Islam.
Exactly. And
there's no room for interpretation.
Like,
yeah. He wasn't really even he was a pan-Arabist, wasn't he? I mean, he was sort of like the idea of I want to put everybody, he was sort of like the modern day Saladin. I'm going to put everybody under my control and we're going to be a modern power.
He was pushing himself into
the
modern
world. He was an ambitious guy,
world.
Kind of like the way Joseph Stalin, who's one of the great monsters of you know, there's a revival of nostalgia for Stalin because he essentially modernized Russia. He's given credit for modernizing Russia, right? I mean, I don't think you don't want to give him any credit because he's probably bigger asshole.
40 million.
Yeah, only about 40 million starved the entire Ukraine. What an a-hole. You know, guys like that and Hitler, just huge assholes.
Yeah, well, on a smaller scale, Saddam starved and drained the swamps in the south.
That had been there a thousand years. Yeah.
There's a story, and it's a story. I don't know the validity to it, but a woman. It's good luck to put a sheep's blood handprint on your car.
Yeah,
so he's going out the house and they put a handprint on this woman and they went down the road and changed cars. And sure enough, the car with the handprint got hit with an RPG.
Yeah.
And they went back and grabbed her and they were like interrogating her. And I've been through what the Iraqis were doing. They're talking about us in Abu Ghraib, believe me, the Iraqis were a little different with interrogations.
Just a little bit, huh?
And they killed 75,000 people of her tribe for that incident.
Jesus.
Allegedly. I don't know if that's a true statement.
Well, you know, he was pretty ruthless. He would take out whole villages.
Doesn't sound like he would... It doesn't sound beyond him. It's not.
Well, and I mean, in the 80s, Anwar Assad, you know, he took out the city of, I think, Hama, which was there was a Muslim resistance there. He went in there and literally leveled the city. And I think ran a road over it. I mean, built a road next to it so people could drive by what used to be the city of Hama. I mean, he killed, you know, I don't know, it's a crazy amount.
A lot of people.
That is the tradition of the Middle East, you know, subjugating people with an iron fist. And I always say that what makes this country great and is that the Constitution is an idea. And it's an idea that has never been, nobody's ever come up with a better idea. And it's what gives it such incredible resilience. It's a living, breathing idea. And that's what we owe such a debt of gratitude to the founding fathers for. The way you beat a bad idea is with a good idea. And I hope that that the Middle East somehow learns that and somehow permeates, and it's very difficult for that to get into a populace, I know, for a lot of other reasons, but you are optimistic.
I'm optimistic. I think Baghdad is going to pull itself out of this.
Yeah.
And in 10 or 20 years will be rival Dubai. I've always said
that.
A financial capital, potentially. The reason why is because Iraq has several things that no other country over there has. It has water. It has two large rivers
Euphrates
running through
and
it.
The Tigris.
Absolutely.
Right. Don't worry about my knowledge.
Arguably, the Mesopotamia, the land between the rivers, the
fertile
of
crescent,
civilization.
It's the Fertile Crescent.
Absolutely.
Where language came from for the first written language.
And they have oil. And they don't have,
The
oil that's
Saudi Arabia
has.
And a nice climate.
But they have a decent climate. They have irritable land. They have a lot of things that no other Middle Eastern country, including Dubai. Dubai is, a financial center and so forth, and it just sprung out of nothing. If Iraq gets their head out of their ass, Baghdad specifically.
It seems to me that getting their head out of their ass really is a question of the Shia and the Sunni figuring out a way to share resources and power.
Right. Yeah. That is it.
Yeah.
Well, and arguably Saddam crushed the Shia and brought the Sunnis to a more Western model.
Yeah, and now you see what's his name?
Alawi.
Alawi or whatever. I can't believe I'm forgetting his name. Yeah. But anyway, he's now Alawi or whatever. He's now consolidating power and pushing the Sunnis out. We'll see what happens.
Sure, it's revenge
it's
thing.
The old,
once they get over that, they do, that's the big if.
Big if.
And the Kurds figured it out. Kurdistan's beautiful. If you ever want to go, I'll take you to Erbil. I have a lot of friends there.
Oh, is that right?
I was planning a
trip
there.
I would take you up
there
on that in a fucking heartbeat.
Yeah, well, I'll take you over there. And I have friends of mine that run that place and have built buildings and high rises. It's taken off.
Wow.
And they've got political issues.
They suffered a lot.
It's safe. We could walk around Erbil, Iraq, just like we walk around Bellevue.
How are the Turks tolerating this sort of Kurdish autonomous
reason? They don't
like
it because they're fighting on the borders.
Right.
Kurdistan, historically, the Brits carved up the area after the Second World War. They didn't care about the Kurdish traditional borders, and they carved Iraq out, and they said, that's Iraq. There's no Kurdistan.
Right.
But Kurdistan actually extends into Syria, Turkey, and Iran.
Tough to be a Kurd for a long time.
But they have done a very good job, and they've been very pro-American, which has helped them to this point.
Yeah.
So,
I want to back up because you said you'd been in the room and listened and watched Iraqis interrogate people.
No, I haven't watched Iraqis interrogate people.
Okay.
If I said that, that's a mistake.
Okay.
I know people that worked for me that were interrogators. And I know the difference. I've had guys. I'll tell you a story. I had. I was interviewing a guy, and
I just have to tell you. If you're listening, you just gave me the quotes.
Yeah,
you gave me the air quotes.
I was interviewing a guy, and I said that if he didn't want to talk to me, we would take him over to Abu Ghraib, and he collapsed.
Jesus.
And I was interested in, and he was on in his words. On his mother's eyes, don't send me back to Abu Ghraib. Abu Ghraib was, if you don't know, you're listening, was the prison that Saddam ran for dissidents, basically.
And horrific things happened.
Yeah, horrific. This guy spent 3 years in Abu Ghraib.
Wow.
And he said for the first I think, I don't remember exactly, but the first several weeks, they wouldn't even interrogate. They didn't talk to him. They would just hang him up with his arms. They would put his arms, tie his arms behind his back, and then lift him up.
That's a good time.
And hang him and tell him, no, no, we're not asking anything. We're just going to beat you and beat him with sticks for 8 hours a day for the first couple of weeks. And then they talked to him and asked him some questions. And when he confessed to being an anti-Saddam guy, I guess, then they put him in a prison cell where he didn't have to stand up all day.
Jesus.
And they used to take turns sleeping on the floor because they had so many people in the room.
Yeah, I read about this.
Sit.
I read about this. People would go crazy.
The scars on this man's body from head to toe.
Jesus.
Whip marks.
It's amazing people can survive this kind of thing. And
not
and
all of them did.
Not all of them did at all. But that really brings me to a question about extraordinary rendition, which is the process by which the CIA would kidnap people and bring them to countries that had fairly lax interrogation laws. I want to talk a little bit about torture, quote unquote, waterboarding, sleep deprivation. What is your position on that stuff? I mean, I know it's a gray area, and I know you're a warrior, and you've done a lot of this stuff. I mean, you've just been in the mix, which and probably, like I said, somebody who has a practical experience in having to get information out of people because it would either save lives or you need it right away. So where do we stand on this? Well, what's the dialogue when it comes to torture, when it comes to extraordinary rendition, when it comes to due process?
Torture, you know, it's all about, legal definitions. My personal opinion, and this isn't the U.S. government, all waterboarding gives you is a sensation of drowning. Yeah, it sucks. No question. Yeah. It sucks.
Have you been waterboarded?
You know, no, I didn't. I did different things, but you know, I've been drowned. Put it that way. And
I have been waterboarded.
Shallow water blackouts.
I've been drowned.
Yeah, I've did shallow water blackouts working out in the pool. It's similar.
Okay.
So the fact is, does it cause irreparable damage? I know people that were tortured, Iraqis that were tortured by the Saddam regime. Mm. And they were missing fingers, broken bones, whip marks all over their body. And waterboarding doesn't do that. It doesn't leave marks on your body. It doesn't. Does it psychologically affect you? That's debatable. Right. I'm not a psychologist or anything in the medical
field. But what you're saying is that waterboarding sure as hell ain't what you described your friend went through. It's not it's not Abu Ghraib under Saddam Hussein. And that's what I always say. It's like, yes, tough. We actually, we waterboard Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, I think, a number of times.
Right.
But there was a very small group of people we actually used waterboarding
on. Right. But the fact is, it works. And you're only using this on, everybody's not running around, hey, let's waterboard everybody. It's not what's going on. It's serious business. And let me tell you, sleep deprivation works as well.
Oh, my God, I bet.
I will tell you.
Fuck, I bet.
They don't always have time to wait for that effect.
Okay.
So,
I got
what
you.
Are you going to do?
If you know that he knows where there's a bomb and somebody's going to die.
I mean, you just don't have time. I've had people, that were awake for a long time and... Unfortunately, it sucks to be awake for that long. It's horrible.
Yeah.
But it doesn't, you don't come out of it missing fingers.
Alexander Solzhenitsyn in the Gulag Archipelago, which is something I recommend everybody read. A lot of you young listeners don't understand, don't realize that just 25 years ago, half the world was living in slavery, basically in communist dictatorships where they couldn't leave their own country.
Some are now.
Some are now. And Alexander Solzhenitsyn was a famous Soviet dissident who spent, I think, 6-7 years in the Gulag Archipelago. The Gulag was the Russian-Soviet prison system under Stalin and under any... Well, they had it for all the way up. They probably still have it.
They still
do. But it's called the Gulag Archipelago because there were so many different prisons. The archipelago means sort of like the island, It's a great book, a very important book to read. And Solzhenitsyn said, he has a chapter. I remember reading it in high school. I think it was labeled the interrogation. He said, anybody who tells you they've stood up to interrogation has not been interrogated properly.
That's a fact.
Yeah,
I think anybody can be broken. I know that's a
there's
fact.
No question.
There's no question.
You were at the top rung of the military sort of commando structure.
Arguably. Yes.
Well, yeah, but I've heard and I've read and I from other people that if you're a Delta Force commando, if you're a Delta operator, and I want to talk about the graduating photographs, because they would take a picture of the graduating class of
yeah,
Delta operators.
Selection,
sometimes
yeah.
sometimes there'd be one person in the picture, sometimes no one.
Yeah.
And that's how. What do you think it was about your... You know, you're obviously a very sturdy guy, so physically you could probably take a lot of punishment.
Right.
You probably don't get cold the way I do. I suck in the cold. You're probably good in the cold. You're not. You just.
My wife's not good in the cold at all.
Yeah, but he's good in
She's
the cold.
She's cold right now.
James Bond over here is good in the cold.
Yeah.
He James can take Bond. It, right? I hate people like him.
That's yeah. okay.
So.
Well, I don't. I'm not going to talk about like what it takes to be a Delta operator, but I do know that the people that are successful.
Yeah.
Are people that can think their terminology is think on your feet and pretty much operate independently and solve problems like problem solvers regardless of what the problem is.
Right,
they're going to analyze things and find a solution.
Did you work a lot of times alone or in just with one other person or a team?
I can't really comment.
Okay. I can't.
I'm not going to comment on any operational part of it.
I want a fucking job where I can go, I can't talk about that.
Well,
I'm
not
going to
say what they do at all. I'm just going to tell you that the people that they were looking for were people that could think on their feet.
Right.
And I don't think there's anything wrong with saying that. And they're intelligent people that operate, if needed, but independently, but they're problem-solving people.
Yeah.
And
they're lateral
physical
thinkers.
Physical people and so forth. I mean, you got to be in a certain level of shape to do these things to get to that point.
Because
other people are problem solvers, but they don't have all the pieces of the puzzle.
But you, sure, and that makes a lot of sense. Do you think, how did you grow up? Did you grow up with a big family, small family?
No, I had two sisters, actually.
Right.
Small family.
Are you good? Can you fix
class
things?
Folks in Connecticut.
Working class.
Yeah. My dad's an engineer from Avco Lycoming, did the M1 Abrams tank.
Oh, wow.
Engine. They just did the engine part.
What was the decision to go into Delta?
Or you know, I joined the Army kind of on a whim because a friend of mine was in the Ranger Battalion, and I said, that sounds fun. I want to move to Washington State. So I was going to join for a couple years just to get out here because I owned a roofing company when I was 20 years old.
Wow.
And I got in the Army and came out to Washington State and was in the Ranger Battalion. And liked it and stayed. And I did 28 years in the Army.
28 years in the Army.
But after 6 years in the Ranger Battalion, I went down to Fort Bragg and tried out and made it.
You know? And you made it.
And actually, a bunch of guys from my platoon, I think, arguably, I've heard this story, that more people from that platoon were in Delta than any other place in the Ranger Regiment.
Oh, wow.
So I don't know if that's true. But
Did you know
that.
Dalton Fury? Have you ever met him?
I know him. You know? I don't know him that well, but I know who he is.
Yeah, I read his book.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, what I like about talking to you, and I've interviewed SEAL Team 6 guys, I've interviewed other soldiers and stuff, and CIA guys, and what I like talking to you, Tom, is that you are not a linear guy. You know, one of the things that was kind of disheartening about interviewing some people is that they're so idealistic or so linear about good guys and bad guys, and I understand you need that mentality when you're on a mission sometimes, but... you're the first Delta guy I've ever talked to, and what's interesting is that you. I would never know it if you didn't tell me.
I don't think I'm a normal Delta guy either.
Oh, you're not. Okay. Yeah. Well, maybe there is no such thing as a normal Delta guy.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, I know lots of them. They don't really. You know, it's kind of a fraternity thing with the unit guys, and I don't have any problem interacting with them. But some of those guys won't talk to anybody. You know.
Yeah.
It's kind of weird.
Yeah.
But, and I'm not. You know, I'm not. Talking about, and I don't like talking about myself. Before I forget, I will like to say, I really appreciate people like yourself that go over there, because you don't have to.
Mm.
You go over there and hang out for 2 weeks, whatever, with the Ranger Regiment, or my wife, who went over there as a, you know, a mom, jumps into, you know, combat photography in Iraq.
I love that. We got to talk about that.
She doesn't have to do that. Well, you don't have to do it, but, you know... It's different for a guy to go over there and hang out in the Ranger Battalion and see what's going on. You're a celebrity, and they say, hey, this is cool.
Yeah.
But to have a single or a a soccer mom. She's not a soccer.
Yeah, give her the mic for a second. We have to talk. I know she's all nervous.
Because I got to be. On.
You got to go pee. Go pee, and then we're gonna go eat. Take this for a second, Melinda. We're gonna talk a little bit. So you were, and I know you met your man, your Delta operator warrior slash whatever he is, in 2008. Because he helped you get into the country, maybe, or there was something. But here's the question: you were a soccer mom, and you decided to go.
Even though
I
don't like soccer, yes, I'm a mom.
But I like it. You're a mom, and you. And again, her book is called "Watching Over Us," and you can get it on Amazon. And it's by Melinda Lambert Bigley. But you what? I mean, you decided to go into a war zone and start taking pictures.
Yes.
Why? I need to hear this. I got to hear the genesis of this. This is a fucking movie.
I don't know if I can articulate the genesis of the reason I went over there, but I think it was a long-standing fascination I had with a certain mentality of person that could go over there and do something that I felt was the most noble course of action.
Did your point of view change about that when you were there?
Lots of small factors changed in ways that I had thought. For example, the hierarchy of the army, things of that nature. Mm. But what I believed as far as what it took for, I still don't consider what I did by going over there anything, but guys that commit themselves to doing, for example, what my husband has done, there are no words for me because of the fact that they have chosen to defend my freedom, your kids' freedom, over their own lives. There's nothing, in my opinion, more noble than that. Because if we don't have freedom, there's nothing.
Right.
And they chose to do that for all of us, and they don't know me. Every night I get to tuck my kids in to bed, and I don't have to worry about them when I close their door.
I love that in A Few Good Men, Jack Nicholson says, "We live in a world of walls, son, and those walls need to be protected by men with guns." And he's just talking like
I'd
that.
I appreciate it's it. Such if you a just great. Say thank you and move on your way.
Yeah. You still need, however, you need
a guy on the wall.
You need a military accountable to civilian oversight. You need a military accountable to civilian scrutiny. You'd still have to ask hard questions. You got to hold our leaders accountable. Those are important things too. I think
but
we have to be careful.
To keep us safe.
Yeah.
To keep us safe from all the bad guys that
all you
got to
do is
about.
Pick up a history book if you disagree with that.
And it's cyclical. And it's not. And you asked about if you think this whole war thing is futile. It's not. It's human nature and it's going to continue. And as long as you've got guys that are willing to protect our freedom, we're going to be okay. But when they stop that from allowing that to happen, then we're in trouble.
Well, and I appreciate it. And I'm going to give the mic back to Tom because I want to ask a question. We're going to wrap this up soon because there is also another factor when it comes to war and being in a war zone. And that is the addiction, the adrenaline, and the danger factor. You know, say what you will. Mm-hmm. You're a Delta. Sure. The fact that you were at that level in the military and other things, you did other things. That's for a man. Like when I talk to you, just to hear about it, and I know, and you've told me some stories that we can't talk about here.
Yeah.
That is very exciting, man. I mean, it taps in for me into an area of my life. It's like the first time I shot a deer. Nobody had to tell me shit. My adrenaline was racing. I dropped that deer, and I ate that deer, and I keep eating that deer. And there was something about it. Like there's a hunter and a fighter in almost all men. And then you meet a Spartan like yourself, a guy who's at the top rung, who's realized his full potential and seen real combat and been all men are drawn to that. If I'm with any of my friends, you know, and I go, that guy was a Delta operator, I'm telling you right now, everybody goes, what the fuck? Seriously? What the fuck? I gotta talk to that guy. So, and I know you deal with that.
I do, but I know what you're saying.
Well, there's that war, like in the Hurt Locker, they said war is a drug, right? I know that's
really
very simplistic. It's simplistic.
Not for me. I, you know, and first of all Delta operators are not the same. A lot of people think, you know, they got some cookie cutter in there.
No.
They're making these robots and so forth.
Sure.
We're not robots. We're just doing our thing. And for me personally, I don't get really thrills about any of that stuff. I've been in five different combat zones across the world, from Panama to Afghanistan to Iraq to other places. And I haven't, I've always looked at when I go into those situations that I'm not coming out of it. I just resign myself to that.
You're already dead.
It doesn't excite me to, it actually, you know, when I get in a high stress situation, I don't get like wigged out about it or excited. I just get calmer, actually, and I just do what I'm supposed to do, and I work it that way personally. That's not everybody's situation. I understand.
What I love about what you're saying is that you know that firsthand because you've been in those situations. Every guy would like to say that, but they don't know until they fucking been there.
That's true, but I mean, and that's and I didn't. You know, the first time I jumped into combat was in Panama, the invasion of Panama.
I remember it.
And you know, I didn't know how I was going to react because it's all training up to that point. And I reacted the way I've always reacted since then.
You're the first one on the ground.
Yes.
What does that mean?
I was the primary jumper and the first primary jump master.
That means you're the first target.
I was the first target. Jeez. The anti-aircraft guns were shooting at us. But they shot more at plane number 4 because we kind of snuck in.
Yeah.
But,
Did you? Did you guys?
Yeah,
you
kind of got by.
You didn't have signs that said, here, no, Delta Force, here we come.
No, but what's the CNN guy, Ted Turner, he broadcast our invasion armada for us. So the Panamanians were ready for us. That was nice of him.
The press. Yeah,
wasn't that great?
You.
But no, I mean, for me personally, it's not, the Hurt Locker's a movie, that's neat, but it's not a drug for me. Mm. I can walk across the street and I'm not missing anything about being in the Middle East. Matter of fact, I got to go to Africa next week, and I don't want to go. I really like to relax now.
Yeah.
But
I would imagine after that, after being in five combat zones and being in the military for 26 years?
28.
28 yeah. years. I would imagine you've probably earned the right to relax a little bit.
Yeah, but I've never been...
never needed the juice.
I know. I don't... Well, I've been doing the top... and military stuff for a long time in the Ranger Regiment in Delta. I've done a lot of those things, and it's repetitive to a certain point. Mm-hmm. You know, some people like to shoot. Some guys are gun freaks. You know, I know how to shoot. I know how to play with guns. I don't do it all day long.
Yeah.
So I was never like that in that case. But
do you think guys like you ultimately will be obsolete with robotics? And
no, never,
no. You still need eyes on the ground.
Not just that. I think that, you know, maybe in 1,000 years from now, we get to the point of decision making. Just a quick story. I had to take a vehicle down in Baghdad at some point, and a friend of mine was watching me and another guy go after these bad guys in a vehicle. They had a bunch of guns. And the guy pointed...
Be more general, Tom.
Well, the guy pointed his AK at me while I was moving towards the vehicle, and I took it out of his hands and the guy that was covering the vehicle with a machine gun couldn't understand what happened, why I didn't shoot the guy. And I said, well, I could tell he was not trying to shoot me. And he's like, how could you tell? I said, I know he wasn't trying to shoot me. Or I would have shot him.
Pattern recognition.
I would have shot him.
Yeah.
But I've been through scenarios over and over and over that I've seen so many different versions of that.
Well,
I can do it in a split second.
Yeah, you can chunk huge amounts of information. Yeah.
And I don't think that's something that, at least in the near future, that computers are going to get to that point yet.
That human intuition
absolutely.
You get from years of experience.
Yeah, whether it's, you know, I'll focus this back on you. You're on stage. You have an audience reacting. You can maneuver yourself as need be based on how many years you've been doing what you're doing.
Yeah,
I mean, it's... Yeah. It's easy for you, but if I was to go up there, you know, I'm not going to make anybody laugh.
You're going to be a fish out of water.
Piss them off. Yeah. I don't know. But, you know.
I don't know how I'd do it as a Delta Force commander. I'd probably be like, is there any cappuccino? We have to wake up now? I'm freezing. I was hiking in Montana. I was with Joe Rogan. I was like,
this fucking
blows.
That's cool.
We were freezing.
Let me ask you, did he shoot anything?
Joe dropped his deer too.
All right.
Joe, I had to pull. He got so excited, he dove into a cactus bush. And I hope they have it on Meat Eater. It's going to air in the spring.
Oh, cool.
But I had to pull quills out of his ass and thigh. So I was like, this is a real friend, bro. That, I'm pulling quills out of his naked ass and thigh. We actually have it on camera. It was unbelievable.
Perfect.
Yeah, we had a great time. It took me 4 days, and finally I saw a deer, and he goes, you want to shoot a doe? I go, I'll shoot anything right now. Yeah. I'm not going home without a deer, man.
You have to.
But I got buck fever. I saw a buck, and my scope was jumping all over the place, man.
Yeah.
And I was going to take a shot anyway. The guy goes, no. You know,
I didn't do that. I shot okay.
Oh, did you?
I'll shoot with you this weekend. I would love to. Well, we'll talk about that later. Okay. But No, I appreciate everything you did, though. I wanted to say that.
Man.
And that's important because a lot of people go over there and support the troops.
Yeah.
We had different people over there, rock groups, all kinds of people.
Yeah.
And it's important that, not for me personally, but I think for the soldiers out there, the guys need to see that. They need to see a civilian person coming
they need
in
to feel something from home, you know.
Absolutely.
For me, it was one of the more, if not the most, moving experience of my life. I saw military ceremonies for guys who were dead at 19. I walked through the hospital, watching those guys when I'd be doing stand up and watching their faces change and stuff. That was what made it so real. And you know, you say what you want about the war. I respect all different opinions, but when you're there and you're watching these guys do the best they can, and they're away from their home for 15 months at a time, two weeks. I remember coming back after 2 weeks and I was just, it just changed my perspective. And I grew up all over the world. I saw a lot of poverty, but to see what these guys were going through and see how dangerous it was on a day, just worrying about the suicide bombers and all that stuff. And I came home and I was at a restaurant and the waiter came over and apologized profusely because they didn't have the lamb Provençal. And I went, brother, I'll take whatever the fuck you got today.
Exactly.
Because I'm a lucky man to be alive. So it was a pleasure. Well, but I appreciate you and your wife coming on the podcast.
No, great. I'll tell you, the worst thing is when you got a call. I never called anybody's mother, but I had to call two guys' wives and tell them their husbands were dead.
Damn.
And you talk about, you know, you see everything. It doesn't really, I don't care who you are. Mm. When you have to tell somebody that their sibling or their wife or their son or whoever, and that is where the reality slaps you. It just really, and I don't care who you are, Delta Opera, I don't care who you are.
Yeah.
You have to do that. And that is the most profound thing that I've ever had to do in my life. Unfortunately, twice.
Mm.
And just something that you can't even describe to people until you're in that situation.
Yeah.
And it was funny because I was in charge of this situation and one of the guys there asked me, well, I can do that for you. And I said, you can, I have to do that.
Yeah.
There's only, you know, when you have that responsibility, you have to do it.
That's gotta be one of the hardest phone calls.
It's tough
to make, man.
It's unbelievable. And I think about it. I don't think about it every day, but I think about that. And the person I was talking about is a very close friend of mine and he's dead. And that's, you know, that's unfortunate.
That dealing with that kind of loss, did it? Do you think that it changed? Of course, it changes you, but I guess perspective and being a warrior is something you're kind of ready for. You can never really be ready for it, but in a way, you are ready for it.
Yes, I. It's not. I can function. At the time,
it
was very, absolutely, it should have been me. It was supposed to be me. We switched seats, basically, on the reason he went out because he had just come back into theater because he wanted to go out, and I was supposed to go myself. I personally think that it wouldn't have occurred the same way if I was out there. So I always think guilt, you know, that I could have changed something had I been on the ground, but that's hindsight.
Well, you can't.
You don't know.
You know, I was talking to Steve Ranella, who took us hunting. He's a great hunter, and he wrote a book called Meat Eater. I recommend to everybody. But, you know, we're going to go to Alaska maybe. And I said, there are grizzly bears, and there are the hybrids now. They're mating with polar bears. I go, should I bring a handgun, man? Because I'm not dying that way, you know? And he said something interesting. He goes, look, getting attacked by a bear is so random. And any of that danger is so random that you can prepare for it, and you're looking this way, and something else happens this way.
Right.
It's not how it works. It's life is just a one big surprise and one continuous mistake, and you can get ready for whatever. You can make our preschools safer and have armed guards there, and it's not going to change the fact that people die, tragedy happens,
right?
And all you can do is hedge your bets and try to have some foresight and learn from history so you don't repeat the same mistakes. What Absolutely. I tell people all the time, and you and I both read enough about history to know that's why you read about history. You've got to know, you've got to be able to read the signs, you've got to read the looming danger,
mm-hmm.
and you've got to be able to know not to repeat the same mistakes for what it's worth.
But to close with, you said the American experience is unique, and the Second Amendment, because that's a big issue right now with all the schools going on,
which is about the right to bear arms, everybody.
The people were armed. The founding fathers armed people to protect them against the government.
That's right.
A lot of people don't understand why they were freeing people to have weapons.
That's right.
It wasn't because they were protecting themselves from criminals. The big issue was to arm yourselves so the government can't overrun you and knows that there's an armed public out there.
Right.
And well, I think that's been lost a little bit in the recent discussions.
I think government has become such an intricate part of everybody's lives that government is an octopus. Government isn't even, it doesn't even belong to Washington anymore. I was talking to my father about this. You can't do business as a corporation without a pipeline to Washington. You can't do business right. without having your own lobbyist representative there. And government is such, it is such a part of so many people's lives. Call it 40, call it 50%. People rely our agricultural system is a socialist system, basically.
Absolutely.
And for more on that, just read Lawrence Lessig's book or another book called So Damn Much Money. This is why it's important to read, so you can get to the root of the problem and not just strike at the branches. Sorry to quote Thoreau.
No, that's
Tom Bigley, Melissa,
Brian,
Melinda Bigley, thank you so much for coming on the Brian Callen Show, and I'm looking forward to eating some food.
Let's go.
And really asking you some classified questions. Yeah, then they're coming to my stand-up. Later, everybody.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show. Be sure to visit briancallen.com for information about this episode as well as past and future episodes. You can follow Brian on Twitter at Brian Callen and like him on Facebook. Go to facebook.com/Brian Callen Comedy. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.